a dictator without elections. Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left. Got to move fast because that war is going in the wrong direction. In the meantime, we're successfully negotiating an end to the war with Russia.
Okay, what you just heard right there is the President of the United States sending a message to the strongman of Ukraine. Now, it's interesting that I use that word strongman. Notice I didn't say the President of the United States sending a message to the President of Ukraine. And this is important. And I know if you're watching this podcast, and I know many of you are here in the United States or in some other Western place, you probably don't know this, but Mr. Zelensky is not the President of Ukraine. There has been no election because he canceled the election. So when I say he's the strong man, he is effectively the strong man. He makes decisions for the country, but he has not been elected by the people of that country. And he's obviously very upset at what's going on regarding what we're going to be talking about today. This is a major, major development for world peace and for the United States and for Europe and for Russia and obviously for Ukraine. What's going on in Saudi Arabia, which is the topic that we're going to be talking about today. But Mr. Zelensky obviously is not happy with what's happening with Saudi Arabia. You got to remember, and we're going to get into this a lot more, but Mr. Zelensky has basically been riding herd. He's been essentially running the show when it comes to everything having to do with U.S.-Ukraine policy. You could say the United States has been running the show and he's been basically the tail that's been wagged, right? Regardless of how you look at it, he's been front and center. Well, that gravy train, as some analysts are calling it, is about to end, if it's not ending already. And this is why Mr. Zelensky shot back yesterday that he was very upset about what was going on in Saudi Arabia, to which Mr. Trump shot back at him kind of in no uncertain terms with that quip that you just heard right there. So this is where we are. And wow. What a trip, huh? How did we get here at this point? By the way, I want to share something you that I think is kind of interesting for those of you who maybe don't know. I'm coming to you right now from the stables or the barn in my wife Suzanne and I have this 5-acre ranch estate in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I took part of like the barn. So from time to time, if you hear some horses whinny, it's because there's a bunch of horses around here. And I've built this studio and I'm doing this show out of here now instead of the show that I used to do, right? I used to have a show on RT that we were very proud of. And my guest who you're about to meet, he and I would have conversations like we're about to have on that show. That show had tens of millions of viewers all over the world in English and in Spanish. It's a very popular show. And by the way, I did that show for RT, a Russian television news network, and I was very proud of that show. I'll say this, and I've said this before, that show, I felt more independence of my narrative as a journalist than I did on the same shows that I used to do on CNN, on Fox, on Univision, on MSNBC. I wrote the show. I gathered the stories. I picked my staff. I can't say that about the other experiences that I had. And yet, and here's what I'm getting down to. For some reason, some people within my government, this country that I adore, this country I came to as a refugee from a communist country, Cuba, decided, five, six months ago, whenever it was, that if I continued practicing my craft as a journalist for RT, I would go to jail. I was told by my government in no uncertain terms that if I continued practicing my craft as a journalist for RT, who they didn't like because they seemed to think that RT favored Mr. Trump. By the way, I don't favor anybody. I'm a journalist. I call them as I see them. They told me I would go to jail, so we had to stop the show. We had to cancel the show. I don't get to do that show anymore. Damn good show. I mean, sometimes I was full of shit. Sometimes I did the best I could to explain things. Sometimes I got it right. I brought on really smart people. I didn't curry favor. And my government said, no, you can't do that anymore. So that's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing a show out of a barn now. You know, nice barn, by the way. We've got air conditioning and everything here in South Florida. But that's, I think that's a very important part of this story, of our story, of you know, why we're communicating the way we're communicating right now. My name is Rick Sanchez, by the way. I call this Journalistically Speaking because I'm a journalist. I've got, look, I'm not some guy sitting in his basement in his underwear talking. I mean, I've got, you know, I've been a part of two Peabody Award-winning teams. I've got four Emmys. I've got a DuPont. I practice journalism. I've interviewed four presidents. I've interviewed Mikhail Gorbachev. I've you know, earned my way to this position that my government is now telling me, or the Biden administration is telling me, I don't deserve to have. All right, let's talk Saudi Arabia. This is fascinating. Not only what Mr. Trump said that I shared with you just a little while ago, but also what Mr. Rubio and others have been saying in Saudi Arabia as they met with others from the other side of this situation in Russia. And here's some of the headlines that I'm going to share them with you real quick, and then we're going to take them apart with my guest, who knows as much about this as anybody. The idea that we're talking about restoring diplomatic relations between the United States and Russia. Wow. Wow. Formation of high-level negotiation teams. In other words, they're actually sitting down and saying, these are the teams that are going to hash this out and work this out. And both teams seem to be adamant about their roles in finding a solution to this horrible problem that we've all seen in Ukraine. We're going to talk about another headline that's coming out of Saudi Arabia, which is the exclusion of NATO troops. In other words, the United States and Russia are both saying, look, we don't need to have NATO troops there because NATO is the reason this war started. The threat of NATO and its actions more recently, not to mention over the past 15, 20 years, is one of the reasons this whole thing started. And my guest will explain all that to us. And then the fourth and final most important point in all of this to be discussed is the Ukrainian participation or lack thereof. The idea that for the first time, you know, we've seen it over the last year where people would meet with Ukraine in Europe and they left Russia out. It's like, why do we need to talk to you guys, right? Which, of course, Mr. Zelensky and some of the members of his government, they love that situation. Now, it looks like there's meetings going on that may or may not involve Mr. Zelensky, and the fact that the Ukrainian team is not being allowed to participate, at least at this level of this conversation, something that has been put together by Mr. Trump, who we know seems to be adamant about reestablishing some kind of relations with Russia. Because why do we have to hate Russia? I don't know. Because Rachel Maddow wants us to? I don't know. It's another great question. So that's where we are. I just set the playing field for you. And now let's get into this. Mark Sloboda is a U.S. Navy veteran, specialty nuclear engineering. He is a security analyst. Few people know about international relations the way he does, specifically as it relates to Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia, etc. He and I have had countless conversations, as I mentioned before on the show, I did on RT, and he's good enough to join us now. Mark, thanks so much for being with us, man.
Rick, thanks for having me. It's a real honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
That's so sweet. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate that as well. And I guess let's start with these bullet points that I just laid out. The restoration of diplomatic relations. Both nations have agreed to work on fully staffing their embassies in Washington and in Moscow. To that, you say what?
That's a big deal. If you know, further negotiations don't go anywhere, let's say they stop today, that would already be significant. And the reason why is that Russia and the United States have not conducted diplomacy at any real level for the last 3 years. We're talking about the countries with the two largest nuclear on Earth, two of the four largest economies in the world. all kinds of global tensions and problems have effectively been on pause because these two countries haven't even been exchanging the time of day with each other for 3 years. In fact, the Russians have made lots of accusations so that what little diplomatic staff they had left, and they didn't have an official approved ambassador for over a year now. Because the U.S. side hadn't gone through the process of confirming, you know, his appointment, what diplomatic staff they had was harassed, right? Was pursued and was harassed on the streets of Washington D.C. You know, basically whenever they left the building and the building itself, it must be said.
Well, I'm going to stop you real quick. I'm going to stop you right there and ask you a question that I feel like if somebody's watching our show in, you know, Kansas or something. They're probably thinking, well, it must take two to tango. If, you know, a couple doesn't get along, it's because neither one of them is trying hard enough, or they each insulted each other, or they both did something wrong, right? And a lot of Americans who don't understand this situation between Russia and the United States, or even the Ukraine situation very well, are probably thinking that very thing. Are they wrong to think that?
Yes, they are wrong.
Maybe it's the question I'm asking.
Yeah, in the, how do we get in to the this context,
where we're not even talking to each other.
Yeah, in the context of specifically of the stopping of diplomatic relations, that is entirely in the Biden administration's, the previous U.S. administration's court, right? Russia has made clear countless times they may disagree vehemently with the United States on Ukraine and on numerous other issues around the world, but they have never refused diplomacy. They have never refused to sit down at the table and at least try to talk out these problems diplomatically rather than resort to military means. They said this well before they intervened in Ukraine in 2022. They presented their security concerns to the U.S. and the Biden administration just blew them off. So it was the U.S. who severed all diplomatic contact. And it must be said that this was pursued by most of Europe as well. And it's done under, I believe, the rationale is this U.S. and increasingly for the Europeans, Western supremacist messianic ideology of exceptionalism. I believe that's because of the dominant ideology in the U.S. and across much of Europe as well, this ideology of American or Western exceptionalism. It is a supremacist messianic ideology whereby its adherents, which is much of the U.S. political class, believe that the U.S. is systemically, societally, and morally superior to every other country, civilization, culture on earth. And therefore, there's different rules of the game. And diplomacy has become seen as a gift. We reward people who bandwagon us, who do what we say, and who agree with us by conducting diplomacy with them. But our adversaries, we don't deign to talk to them. And when you don't talk to your adversaries, that defeats most of the real purpose of diplomacy.
Bismarck, that leads me to this question.
Rolling in his grave.
I'm hearing you say this, and I'm thinking to myself that there are those like yourself and others astute enough to have followed the situation in Ukraine, the situation with Russia, and the situation which led up to the situation in Ukraine. And among those things is the question of provocation, a Mearsheimer kind of thought process that Sachs and other economists and people talk about all the time. If you look for them, interestingly enough, they're all over YouTube. There is a thinking that used to be a small amount of people who thought about this and talked about this, and now it's getting bigger. That A, post-World War II, the United States has done everything possible to shit on Russia. B, since late 80s, 90s, the United States has actually become very aggressive toward Russia. C, the United States once promised after Germany reunified that it would not allow NATO to just start gobbling up everything all the way to the Russia border, and actually even said so, and then broke its promise and has been extremely aggressive. And then D, of course, the United States, when it comes to Ukraine specifically, was not only aggressive, but fomented a coup in 2014 to remove the government of Ukraine, who they didn't like simply because the government was somewhat friendly with Russia and they didn't want anybody to be friendly with Russia. Okay, I just explained what a lot of people talk about and a lot of people know and a lot of people truly believe. Here's my question. These negotiations that we saw in Saudi Arabia, these comments that we're getting from this new administration, how much of that do you think is now bought into? We knew the Biden administration, any of those points that I just made, Joe Biden and his people at the State Department would have told me I was completely full of shit. But how much of what I just explained do you believe there are now people in this new administration who say, yeah, some of that stuff Sanchez just said is kind of true. We may have created this scenario that we have that's so antagonistic with Russia. What do you think?
Okay, so I would say it's a mixed bag. I mean, when we take a look at this administration, it's got some contradictions. I mean, we have Tulsi Gabbard and RFK Jr. on one hand, and we have Mark Rubio and Mike Waltz on the other hand, right? You know, so neocons versus those who you want to call them anti-hegemonists. I don't know what you want to call them, but who have been very critical of U.S. foreign policy. So I would say that they have both views represented within the administration. I think Trump probably likes arguments being held in front of him where he gets to choose. And I think probably the most important thing is that Trump himself believes this, or agrees with this narrative, vice the narrative that the American people have been presented with, the Biden administration narrative of what has been happening in relations with Russia and over events in Ukraine. He agrees with it. And he said himself, there was just a question, he was asked a question about his comments that the leader of the Kiev regime, Volodymyr Zelensky, that elections must be held in Ukraine to determine a legal negotiating partner. And one of the journalists says, that's a Russian talking point. And Trump was, that's my point. That's not Russia's point. That's what I think.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty strong. That was quite.
And by the way, that Russian talking point thing is something that is almost like the number one refutation, argument point, whatever the hell we want to call it, from anybody who you have a conversation with about Ukraine or Russia. It's always, they won't say, I'm going to disagree or take apart your argument based on data or information. No. Oh, so you're a Putin apologist. Oh, so that's a Russian talking point. Boy, it seems almost deceptive and unfair to argue that way. But it's funny that of all people, the president of the United States got hit with that and shot back the way you best shoot back at somebody who bullies you. And that is to say bullshit. He's basically calling bullshit, right?
Well, for the four entire years of his presidency, he was accused of being a Russian puppet. That is what the Russiagate hoax, you know, this political persecution of him was, you know, that was all debunked and baseless, was all about. And it's become, you know, kind of accepted in the Western mainstream media that any criticality of U.S. foreign policy, at least under the last administration, was essentially tantamount to treason. If you criticize U.S. foreign policy, you were saying things that the Russian does. Well, you know, sometimes Russia was right, right?
Yeah, two things can be correct at the same time. It can be a point that Russia's made, and it can also be true.
That can't possibly be true, because we know that everything Russia says is lies and propaganda, not what we say, right? I mean, that's the narrative that's presented. And Trump just steamrolls. He bulldozes over that and just ignores it. He obviously is much more confident and politically secure within his own administration and within the Republican Party than he was during his last administration. And I think what we're seeing, wherever this goes, it's quite clear that this is the biggest rupture that has ever happened in modern U.S. history.
It's a fascinating, absolutely fascinating scenario to watch this develop the way it is developing, and as fast as it's developing, to see for the first time ever somebody sit in the Oval Office who is looking at the people who have made decisions for this country in the past, oftentimes without concerning themselves with what the guy in the Oval Office cared to do, and essentially saying, no, I will decide what our foreign policy is, and I'll certainly understand and want to hear what you guys have to say, but you won't tell me what the fuck I'm doing. That's over. That seems to be the message. I mean, I hate to be so crude, but that's kind of what he's saying.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He's making clear he's the decider. During his first administration, he just threw away the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, the you know, nuclear treaty. And, you know, you can argue whether that was right or wrong. I think it was wrong. I don't agree with Trump on everything, but it's clear that he has control of his foreign policy in a way that he never did during his first administration, and that he intends to change U.S. foreign policy from the orthodoxy it has been for decades in a very different direction. Now, whether he can succeed or not, he's up against the entire blob, as Ben Rhodes calls it, the deep state, the permanent bureaucracy, whatever, however you want to term it. And it's going to be a challenge, but it's certainly going to be interesting.
It certainly looks like my friend and the guy who grew up across the street here with me in South Florida, the other guy who is the other Cuban guy who kind of came out of this community, Marco Rubio, is, though probably still a neocon at heart when it comes to Ukraine, he's sounding an awful lot like a reformed neocon. Yeah. Are you getting that sense as well? Is that by necessity?
I'm getting the sense that he is a smart political, I'm a cynic. I believe not that Mark Rubio has undergone some type of Damascene conversion. Right. I don't necessarily believe that neocons are capable of that. I'm sorry. But he is a smart political operative who has seen where the prevailing winds are going, where the Republican Party is going. And he is playing ball with a very powerful president, very powerful figure, both, you know, within the Republican Party and throughout. And, you know, he's become Secretary of State of the deal. And whether he agrees with everything Trump says or not, and I suspect he doesn't, he is going to follow Trump's lead, you know, when Trump is the president, and then, you know, try to, you know, move his political career on from there. That's what I see. And, you know, really, that's what Trump needs, rather than, say, people in his last administration, like John Bolton, right, who came out in his memoirs and admit that most of his administration spent 4 years just trying to figure out how they could manipulate and hide information from Trump to get him to do what they wanted him to do. That doesn't seem like it's happening this time around, at least not thus far.
Sounds like your answer is by necessity then. By the way, let's go back. I want to underscore something that you and I were just talking about. And that is the dog tag wagging the tail, or the tail wagging the dog, that we've had in past administrations where U.S. presidents took their marching orders, it seemed, from people within the, oh God, I'm going to say it. I don't like using this word because it makes me sound like a conspiracy theorist, which I'm not. But there is kind of a deep state in the United States. There are people who've been there for tens of decades, many, many, many years, making decisions and overriding administrations, whether it was Clinton or Carter or Reagan or Bush or whoever the hell, or even Trump was in the White House the last time he was there. And I'll give you two stories that kind of bring this to light. Very few people got a chance to see my friend Tucker Carlson's interview with Vladimir Putin. But in that interview, Mr. Putin said a couple of things that I thought were extremely noteworthy. And he took us through the points very meticulously. And that is, during the Clinton administration and during the Bush administrations, he personally sat down with those presidents and their advisors like Condoleezza Rice in the case of Bush, and said, in one case, let me join NATO. Why do you have to have our country outside of NATO when we can be part of this force for supposed good? And that was beloved as an idea by Mr. Clinton, I believe, at the time. And it was either Mr. Clinton or Mr. Bush. And then when they took it up the chain to the people who, I guess, really make decisions, they poo-pooed it, as we say, and said, no, we're not doing that. He can't get into NATO. Even though the president himself liked the idea. In the case of Condoleezza Rice, I believe it was discussion about nuclear warheads and how maybe the United States and Russia can create some kind of conjoined force and combine their weaponry to protect the rest of the world, to which I believe it was Condoleezza Rice said, that sounds like a great idea. Mr. Bush, I think, said, that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to take that back to our folks, and we're going to have discussion. I'll get back to you on it. A couple days later, they get back to Mr. Putin and say, we don't want that. No. We'd rather be able to point our weapons at you, and you point yours at us. Those two stories that most Americans never heard because nobody was allowed to watch the Putin interview because for some reason we were told it was all Putin propaganda, highlight exactly what I'm talking about when we say that Mr. Trump is a real outlier when it comes to the way politics as usual have been run in the United States, namely that the president himself becomes the president but doesn't actually make presidential decisions. Those are made for him. And those two examples, I think, highlight it. Whether I may have gotten some of the facts a little bit wrong or not is something you can fix, Mark, or you know, I'll ask viewers to pardon me on that.
Yeah, not at all. No, it's true that Russia has multiple times, right, pressed to be included in what is the security architecture for Europe, right? NATO, right? Russia realized that, you know, with the Soviet Union dissolved, supposedly the need for an organization that was built to, unofficially, officially keep the Russians out, keep the Americans in, and keep Germany down. But of course, it wasn't dissolved. So Russia said, well, we're going to dissolve it. Then let us inside so that it's not a security bloc positioned against us, but we're part of the security bloc, thereby knowing we're not going to be targeted by that security bloc. And I mean, that was still one of Russia's main concerns that they presented again to the United States in 2021 with their security, pleas, right, before they intervened in Ukraine. And it's about Russia's security and how NATO is and has been the most powerful and the most aggressive military bloc on Earth. It's never been used defensively, but it's been used as a tool of U.S. hegemony in Libya, in Serbia, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and others, you know, multiple times. And Russia didn't want to be targeted by NATO anymore, so they tried to get in. But Russia's too big, right? That it would interfere with U.S. control of Europe too much, right? It would be an independent, right, voice within the patron. So that is, it wasn't big enough. And the United States, you know, was still set on hegemony, on primacy. And NATO was very useful in confronting, you know, any potential independent challenger to that global influence and control.
It seems like so far afield of everything that most of us learn as people. I think back to, being a Catholic kid growing up here in Miami, and going to church and being told that if, your neighbor puts his hand out, you shake it. And when your enemy comes to you and says, I want to be your friend, you accept him. And yet that's the story that you and I are talking about right here, where country like Russia, whether we want to categorize them as enemies or foes or friends or suspicious, whatever the hell you want to call them, when somebody comes to you, at least this is the way my priests and my dad and my mom brought me up, when somebody comes to you and puts out a hand and says, let's work on something together, and and you turn your back on that, I'm not sure you're in the right. And I think this is where sometimes, you know, just from a total humanistic standpoint, I'm disappointed that my government has in so many cases done that. And here we are now, the news of the day, the reason you and I are talking is, it looks like for the first time, somebody is accepting that hand and saying, let's build something where we can trust each other. And not only are they saying, let's you and I trust each other, but they're also saying, and here's the big news, ready? Drum roll. Brrr. They're saying we may end up doing this at the exclusion of the EU, Ukrainian participation, and NATO. Wow.
Yeah. Basically because the Trump administration feels that they would interfere with the process, at least in the initial stages. We saw what has been done so far is mostly bilaterally attempting to start the repair of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia, right? That was what was done.
Right.
Or, you know, they, for as far as goes, they agreed we're going to meet more, and this is our initial positions. That's all that was done, right? So there actually wasn't any real reason for the EU and the Kiev regime in Ukraine to be in that room, because they would have been completely opposed, because they are still politically, ideologically, vehemently opposed to even talking to Russia. They're not ready for peace. Right. They don't even want to talk about peace, because the terms that they would get because of the reality on the battlefield is not acceptable to them. Right. The Trump administration in the U.S. believes differently than the Biden administration. They say they have a realistic assessment, and that the Europeans and the Ukrainians and the Biden administration before them was living in a la-la fantasy land. And they're not doing, they're not repairing relations with Russia. They're not trying to come to a settlement in Ukraine out of some moral beneficence. They believe it's because it's in the U.S.'s national interests to do so. And I hate to burst the humanistic bubble. Personally, I'm a bit of a cynic and a misanthrope myself. But the way you deal with other people is not the way that international relations, the way that states deal with each other. And Trump is doing what he should as president. It's just that his idea of what the U.S. national interest is, particularly with regards to Russia and Ukraine, is radically different than what the Biden administration's was. And I think you can make the argument that the Biden administration's policy on Russia and Ukraine, whatever, it has failed, and it failed catastrophically from what their intentions were.
I'm glad you said that. I want to play something now for our audience. This is fascinating. Here is, after all the things that you and I have just spoken about and the complexity of this relationship between the United States and Russia, which goes back not just through Biden, but before Biden for decades, with all of this, I now want to play for you a conversation the other day that took place in the New York Times. This is the New York Times show podcast called The Daily. And they brought together a roundtable of all their experts, all their smart people at the New York Times, their reporters, including the guys who cover this situation in Ukraine. I wanted to trip and fall as I was listening to this podcast while I was jogging the other day, when I heard the New York Times explain in no uncertain terms what seemed to me their justification of what you just described as the Biden principle when it came to Ukraine. Almost making it sound like everything that Biden was doing was absolutely correct, everything Ukraine was doing was absolutely correct, and everything Russia was doing was abominable. Here, take a listen.
To help support the Ukrainians against an invasion that they neither prompted nor saw. That was the Biden position. The second argument
we should explain that when you're in Europe, that's what the sirens sound like behind you.
I was going to ask you if you really wanted to hear these, but now you know I'm really immune.
No, you're not faking it.
It's like a Mission Impossible movie.
Just because it's such a better siren song than what we have here.
Yeah, it is. So the old strategy also was, whenever we are ready to go into a negotiation to end the war, it will be nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. And that means that the Ukrainians will be at the center of the negotiation. Mm-hmm. And no one's going to give away their country the way one did in colonial times.
So there's no mention, no context in that discussion about the possibility that maybe we may have provoked the situation in Ukraine, that maybe Russia had its cause for what it did. I'm not making excuses for Russia. I'm just saying there are two arguments here that should be heard. Certainly the President of the United States is hearing them. And here's the New York Times just the other day doing its show on this topic and making it sound like Trump is crazy and Biden is a genius for his policy. How in the hell do Americans get beyond this kind of thinking? And what do you make of that comment, Mark?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think a lot of slow work in the media by figures such as yourself is really one of the only ways, at least from the ground up to change this. Maybe Trump changing U.S. foreign policy. And in some ways, it may be for the better. In some ways, it may be for the worse. We'll have to see. But maybe that will start to have an effect from the top down, to change Americans' perception of the world and of Americans' place. You know, hopefully they can find a constructive place in that world rather than a domineering one. But I guess we can hope on that regard, if hope is your thing. It's not really my thing. I don't do hope. So it is really hard because the New York Times also similarly in the last 2 weeks did an article trying to claim that Joe Biden had won in Ukraine, like that they accomplished everything they wanted to, right? And that they never believed that Ukraine would win, or they never they just wanted to weaken Russia. But even on that regard, right? This sanctions war, right? That the U.S., where they weaponized their control of the global financial and economic architecture in an attempt to crush Russia's economy, thereby, stopping the intervention and leading to a political crisis in Russia that they hoped would unseat Putin. None of that worked. In fact, do you remember Jen Psaki saying the ruble was rubble? Not so much. The Russian economy is growing. The Russian economy has been growing its GDP at a faster rate than the United States has. In the last few years of this sanctions war, Russia jumped in terms of GDP or purchasing power parity, which is the only real way to compare economies. They jumped both Germany and Japan to become the fourth largest economy in the world while their economy was supposed to be destroyed, right? That to me says that the Biden administration did not only not understand the Russian economy, but they didn't understand the global economy and commodity market at all either. That's a big failure.
So let's finish where we started. Engagement, because that's really what we're talking about. That clip from the New York Times says so much about when even the members of your media aren't willing to engage, aren't willing to hear out the other side, aren't willing to present both sides of a story. We've got a problem. You and I grew up in a time where there actually was engagement. We engaged with the Soviet Union, who was supposedly our mortal enemy at the time. So chosen that way, by the way, I think, and according to a lot of people. But Phil Donahue would do shows in New York where he invited Brezhnev on the show to take questions from, housewives, as his show was famous for doing. Nightline with Ted Koppel had an exchange with Russian reporters on a weekly basis where they would argue points of view. We come from a history of engagement with Russia and other countries that we have disagreed with. Somewhere, our media, our institutions, our politics, and more Democrats than Republicans, but all neoconservatives, have made a decision for us, the people, that we don't need to engage anymore. We don't need to talk to them. We don't need to listen to them, and we don't even need to present their point of view. I just can't help but say, and this is why I'm fighting to get back on the air to do the show that I used to do, you and I, on RT. This is why I'd like for other people to do what I do. There should be Americans doing news in Russia and in China and in Iran and in Israel and wherever. And it seems like we've gotten away from that, and it's not leading us in a good direction. For myself, I don't want to speak for you, but I am like a dog with a bone going to do everything possible to try and create more of this engagement, not less.
Yeah, I think it's something that is, you know, one of the challenges of our times. And without trying to present, and I'm not so sure that presenting a golden age of media objectivity in the past, I don't think it was ever that. But there's no question that there was a greater degree than there is now. And I think it's simply that because the American psyche became drunk on the unipolar moment, the moment of the 90s and the 2000s. And it is the Trump administration, again, who has said outright, right? We heard Mark Rubio say this. The unipolar world is over. The multipolar world is now being born, if not actually in effect. The realities have changed, whether we wanted them to or not. The U.S. is not sitting astride the world anymore, you know, able to and willing to do what it can, when it wanted, to who it wanted. It has to engage now, right? It can't engage militarily against everyone or antagonistically against everyone everywhere. It has to diplomacy. It has to talk. It has to consider other points of view, if only to understand them for diplomatic negotiation purposes. And it's going to take a long, hard slog, I think, to get Americans back to thinking that way. I hope you're successful. I just got out of Dodge and emigrated. I chose the easy route.
Mark Sloboda, what a pleasure it is to talk to you. This is a smart conversation, and I hope you guys enjoyed it, because, you know, I think it's important to have these conversations. I think it's important, you know, as we were just referring to engage. But, you know, it involves all of us trying to get a better understanding of the real situation and not buying into the bullshit. And that's what we try to do. We're trying to cut through the bullshit as best we can. I mean, might we be full of shit from time to time? Yeah, sure. And let me know. If you think I'm full of shit, I say, let me know I'm full of shit. But I think it's really important to take in these perspectives. And that's why we have this conversation. That's why I call this Journalistically Speaking, because there's a lack of journalism going on these days. I'm Rick Sanchez. I want to thank once again my guest, Mark Sloboda, for joining us, and you for joining us as well in this conversation. And if you get a chance, and if you like what you heard, subscribe. We'll be here doing this continuously.